You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 86. Experience is simply the name we give our mistakes. Oscar Wilde.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And guys, I have a special treat for you. If you are interested in getting a three-part video series on screenwriting and how to write blockbusters in Hollywood today by some Oscar winners, some multi-billion dollar screenwriters, all you got to do is head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/free-video-series. Sign up for it there and you will get three amazing videos, almost an hour in length total, in your inbox. So just head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/free-video-series. Now, guys, today we have on the show returning champion Daniel Calavisi, who is the author of Story Maps. And his book is not only a bestseller on Amazon, but he also wrote another book, Story Maps for Television. I wanted him to come back on the show to really break down how to write a pilot, how to write a show, do a show Bible, and use the story mapping technique specifically in television and streaming, because in the current marketplace, there is a lot more opportunity for screenwriters to work in television and streaming than it is to work in Hollywood blockbuster studio films. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Daniel Calavisi. I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion Daniel Calavisi. How you doing, my friend?
Good. How are you doing?
How's good.
The pandemic.
We're just hanging in there in this crazy upside down world. I keep telling people I feel like we're in Back to the Future 2 and we're in the other timeline. We are just now living in an alternate universe that I didn't sign up for.
I know. It doesn't feel quite real. It's like everything's kind of on hold.
Everything is just a weird place to be, but as they say in the business, the show must go on. One way, shape, or form. And the creative process has not stopped. Writers are writing and creators are creating, and we're here to help as much as we can. So the first time I had you on the show, your episode was very, very well received and has been downloaded thousands and thousands of times. So I wanted to kind of bring you back on to discuss your amazing concept of story mapping, but specifically for television, because television is the – and when I say television, everybody, I mean streaming. I mean traditional television. We'll just say television for lack of a better term. But that includes Netflix and Hulu and all the other places we're talking about. But I want to kind of focus on that because a lot of people are starting to write more and more for that. I think there's much more opportunity in television now than there ever was, that there is right now in film and independent film. If you're a screenwriter, you more likely will get a job in television than you will, writing a blockbuster. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot more opportunities. There's a lot more jobs. They're just, writers are getting hired off of Twitter in some cases. To staff on shows,
How does that work
with studio features?
So, how does that work? Is that a specific story you know of?
It's, yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest story was Rob Delaney, who was kind of already kind of a famous comedian, but he had a big Twitter presence, and he was noticed by Sharon Horgan, who was well-known for TV in the UK, and they ended up co-creating that show, Catastrophe. And so he's really big. That was a really big show for Amazon.
Yeah.
And he's really big now. And it was mostly because he was just hilarious on Twitter, you know. But there's many other instances, mostly in comedy, because people can just kill on Twitter and then they get noticed and somebody emails them and says, hey, you know, do you have a pilot?
That's such a crazy, ridiculous story. But yes, it makes all the sense in the world because, and I say ridiculous because it's kind of ridiculous. Like how is that? I know a lot of people listening, they're like, I've been busting my ball and all I have to do is do a good Twitter account. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it happens.
Well, I think the key with any social media is consistency. Like if you do it every single day, you're going to get noticed, you know, like it used to be YouTube stars. Now it's TikTok stars.
Instagram.
Like people put out Instagram. They put out something every single day, which I could never do. I don't have the patience and the, you know, I was telling you offline that I need deadlines and stuff. But people who do that, they prove that they have a work ethic and then they back it up with talent. So
it is a weird world we live in, my friend. A weird world. It's not 1982 anymore. That's for damn sure.
I know.
So I wanted to.
It just occurred to me the other day. I'm like, it's not 1982.
It's not good. Though I actually saw something on Facebook or Twitter that was an image. It's like there was a highway and there was a turnoff, and it's like 2020 straight ahead, 1980 turnoff if you want to go back.
Oh, I saw that.
the car was taken off. I don't know. Hard right. I don't know. I might. If I can go back with what I have in my head, obviously right away. Let's go back to 1980. But
yeah.
It was simpler times. It's simpler times. Simpler times. So first and foremost, how do you story map an idea for television?
Well, you start with what I call the basic story map, which is things like your protagonist, your theme, your compelling crisis. Your compelling crisis is really the core conflict of your concept. It's essentially like your log line, basically. And it has to be an engine that can continuously go and continuously generate stories. So let me give you a few examples here. So Breaking Bad, and this will kind of sound like a log line, but it's really the engine for the whole show. A mild-mannered high school teacher becomes a drug lord under the nose of his brother-in-law, a DEA agent. So that's like the core of it. And you can imagine, okay, that could generate six seasons, you know, and it did. Sons of Anarchy was Hamlet and a biker gang. Okay. It was stepfather and son fight to keep a gun running biker gang together amidst corruption, betrayals, and escalating violence. The Americans, two Russian sleeper agents in the 1980s pose as the perfect suburban couple by day as they run missions by night, which ironically bring them closer as real lovers. So if you can get that engine, you're off to a great start.
So like, so the log line, so those, all those log lines, you have to kind of think as a writer, you're like, okay, I love the term story engine because it's mm-hmm. like, you know, when you throw something like the Breaking Bad log line in, it just writes itself almost like, oh yeah, you can, mm-hmm. there's so many stories you can plus out there, but like, oh, a boy meets girl and boy loses girl and girl, and then they get back together. That's not much mm-hmm. of a story engine.
Yeah. And it's, and that not only is it not specific and you want to get as specific as possible, but that suggests a closed ending. And with TV, you don't want closed endings like you do with feature films. So
yeah,
you
because,
want them to keep going.
Right. So Breaking Bad arguably could have gone for another 3-4 seasons, I think.
Yeah.
Comfortably.
You could just keep evading the law, basically.
And at a certain point, it wears out its welcome. You know, like, I mean, any of these cop shows like Hawaii Five-0, I think just went 9 or 10 seasons and they just stopped it. But those kind of shows are like SWAT and I know TV shows are not really in vogue right now, but, our police TV shows. Yeah. Procedurals are not really in vogue right now, but, or like a show like Bones, which ran for 12 seasons, I think it was.
Yeah, something like that.
It just keeps, it's just, you'll never end. It could never end. It's up only basically when the audience just says, you know, we're good.
Yeah. That's what they call the case of the week, you know, or like on X-Files, the monster of the week or the alien of the week, you know, something like that.
But so there's so on those procedural shows, well, on those kind of shows, like X-Files is a great example. There is the week, the monster of the week, but then there's also the underlining season story and then the underlining story engine of the entire series. So yeah, the entire series is the truth is out there. Mulder is trying to get the truth. So that's the engine. But that year, it's like whatever that guy was called, Cancer Man, I think he was, the guy who kept smoking.
Smoking Man.
So there's a whole season on discovering who that guy is, basically. And then after that, then there's the next big. So there's this underlining story that kind of keeps going, and they kind of dabble onto it, even when they're dealing with the monster of the week, and they kind of go back to it. Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. So in that case, you would call that a hybrid, a scripted and procedural hybrid. So not only is there the procedural case of the week, but there's ongoing arcs below it. Like with Mulder, it was related to the disappearance of his sister. And he believed that his sister was abducted by aliens. And I'm not sure. I don't think that lasted the whole, you know, 10 seasons. Maybe that was like the first three or four or something. But that pushed it. That was the arc behind it. So it would come up every few episodes. And then as it went on, as it kind of got into the more modern era of television, it became more of a narrative scripted series where there were less of the monster of the week type of thing.
Right. I was just watching.
And that happens when just the audience gets sucked in and they want more character work. They want to learn more about the characters.
Right. As opposed to just like the monster of the week kind of deal. So like I, my wife and I watched all of Bones, cause we're just catching up on all the shows as we're in quarantine. And there was always that one thing. I forgot. I think it was that, for the main character, the female, Bones herself, it was the father or something like that. And that she could never find the bones or something something that kept her going for a long time with Castle. It was the same thing for Beckett, the main character. Her father was killed and she could never discover who it was. And that kept going for like four or five seasons. That show went on for like 10 seasons as well. But then you're right. After like three or four seasons, it kind of either, they can't keep that going for 10 years. Mm-hmm. They'll go for 3 or 4 years and then they'll pick something else up and take that and kind of keep driving the show. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I think it was The Blacklist on NBC. Not. And I don't know if they 4 or 5 seasons, then finally they just said, yes, he's her father. And
yeah.
Then they went on with it from there. You know, it wasn't as much of a mystery anymore.
Yeah. Spoiler alert by anyone who has not seen The Blacklist. I just finished watching The Blacklist. So I completely understand.
Oh, wow.
It was like that whole thing. Like, is he the father? Is he the father? And we all kind of knew it was that, but then there was the other thing, like, well, what's his secret? And what is she? And now she's turning bad. Like she's gone into this whole Breaking Bad thing in that series. Like she's gone.
I haven't seen it. You know, I haven't seen it recently. I kind of just watched the first season. So
it gets a lot better. It gets a lot better than the first season. So you have time. Might as well pick it up again.
I know. Yeah.
Now, how do you create a compelling character that can carry a series? Because a lot of times, you know, I watch a series and it's starting out and it's just the characters. The character himself or herself is not strong enough to hold the weight of a whole series. It might hold the weight of a movie, might hold the weight of a few episodes, maybe a season, but not for a run of 5, 6, 7, 8 seasons. I mean, what do you do to kind of create that compelling character?
Well, I think they have to have a compelling backstory or what you might call their ghost. Like Don Draper on Mad Men, he had this backstory where Don Draper wasn't his real name. He assumed the identity of a guy that he was serving in Korea with. And this officer in Korea, they were in a battle together. The officer whose name was Don Draper died and they confused the two and they thought he was Don Draper and they thought the guy who died was Dick Whitman. And so he just assumed the guy's identity and totally rebooted his life. Came to New York and ended up becoming an advertising executive. So So he has this whole backstory, which essentially is a federal crime, right? So he's kind of evading the law. Like, he doesn't want people to know his secret. And it's all about this duality that he's pretending to be another person, really, the whole time, which matches up with and kind of parallels his occupation, which is advertising. You know, advertising is pretending this glamour, you know, this glamorous world to sell baked beans or whatever it is. So that's an example. But in my story map, I say there's four things that you want to define for a protagonist. So this is right off the bat, before you even start writing the pilot. Mm-hmm. This is just your initial outline. So I go with defining characteristic, skill, misbehavior, and Achilles heel or flaw. So the defining characteristic could be their occupation, or could be just something that could be something they're good at, or could be just some way to capture them. Okay. The skill is something that they're really good at. So like Walter White, his skill was obviously chemistry, you know, so he was good at that. So he was able to make that. The misbehavior is a quirk or trait that consistently generates conflict. So maybe they have no filter and they're always talking out. Maybe they're making funny asides. Maybe they're a snob, you know, something. And then the Achilles heel or flaw, which may relate to their ghost, is that thing that can destroy them. You know, so like in I would say probably in Mad Men, Don Draper's Achilles heel or flaw is that he's actually Dick Whitman. He actually is not the person that he's saying he is, you know.
So like in Tony Soprano's ghost or secret is you can't – if anybody in his crew found out that he was going to a therapist, it'd be done.
Yeah, I would say his therapist. Initially, there was a lot with his mother, right? Like he kind of had a big mother complex.
Right.
So she was almost kind of his Achilles heel as well. But his defining characteristic – I would say he's kind of impatient, or he's, I don't know, the frustrated leader. Maybe like he kind of doesn't want to be the leader mm-hmm. in some ways, you know. And then his skill is he is a pretty good leader. And his misbehavior maybe is that he's violent. You know, he has a temper.
Right.
You know,
he'll go off the handle.
So those are characteristics that go into him. And that you could use to write him, you know.
So those four elements really do help to set up a compelling character in a series that could hold the series for a while.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's like the minimum that you would need.
Now, I mean, and I'm sure you found this a lot of times when shows start, you know, as they say, jump the shark, to refer mm-hmm. to Happy Days back in the day. When a show jumps the shark, a lot of times either that story engine has run out of gas, or the character it's himself or herself has kind of either caught whatever was interesting about them before has either been waned, it's watered down, it's been resolved, and they haven't been able to pick up another thing to keep that character going. Because obviously, like, I have not seen Mad Men, believe it or not. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure somewhere in the series did they find out his secret. And, you know.
Yeah, certain people along the way.
Well, yeah. Found out. But is there like an explosion, meaning like a story explosion that like everybody, the cops come in and he's arrested? Like, is there a moment like that?
There never really is, no.
Okay. So I kept that.
The end of the first season, there's a big confrontation. His nemesis tries to turn him into the boss, and the boss says, who cares? Which is kind of funny. So he ends up winning in that sense.
Right. All right. But so a lot of times if you're not able to keep that thing going, the show just dies because it's not interesting. And I found that a lot of times when I watched, I think 6 seasons of The Walking Dead, and it just got to a point where I was just like, I can't anymore. I mean, it was great at the beginning and mm-hmm. it was awesome, but it just, at a certain point, you're just like, again.
And do you think it was that it was just the devices kept being repetitive, or that you didn't care about the characters anymore?
No, the specific, I could tell you exactly the moment when Deegan showed up. When Deegan, the arch, which is supposed to be the biggest, baddest, bad guy. Negan. Yeah. The biggest bad guy in the Walking Dead universe, according to the comics, shows up, and everybody was so excited when he showed up and everything. His antagonist was so brutal in the point where the good guys could not get a lick in. So that it was too overpowering. It's kind of like when the villain is too strong and the main and all the other characters, nothing they did. That he just constantly beat them and beat them and beat them. So even in a fight, even in a Rocky fight, you know, Drago beats him up in Rocky IV and is beating him. And you're like, oh, but Rocky gets in a lick and cuts him. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute, there's a chance. So it's just like, you know, it's like The Rock going after a 5-year-old. Like, there's nothing the 5-year-old's going to do that's going to physically match up. And at that point, it gets boring. And then also, I've also built up a love for the characters, and I don't want to see my characters constantly get just abused. I get once in a while, but it was just constant. And I just like both my wife and I just said, you know what? We can't. I can't take. And it was a season of this. And even at the end of the season, it was really the guy's still there.
They didn't get a win.
They didn't. Not really. And if they did, I didn't remember it. It wasn't appeasing enough for me. So I just walked away. And now I'm hearing that, you know, what's his name's coming back, and after he left the show, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting, but I can't. But I go, is Negan around? Oh, Negan's still around. I can't. And like, if they would have killed him in the first season, that would have probably kept going the first time he showed up. But he just keeps coming back. So that was my feeling.
There are shows that are just too dark, and you get sick of it. You get sick of your characters losing. You
know? Right.
You want them to have a win. They need to have a win every now and then. You know, and you need to root for them to have a win. But if you know they're just going to lose and it's just going to be a complete downer,
right?
Then you might bail out of a show.
Right, and that's a lot of times why people bail out of their sports teams, because they just keep getting beat up all the time. And you're like, well, there's the only reason you watch a sporting event or you watch a movie or a show is because you hope that whoever you're rooting for has a chance. So like the Avengers, perfect example. Thanos was fairly an unstoppable object. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they established him so beautifully in Infinity War, where within the first 10 minutes, he literally wipes the floor with the Hulk, which is arguably the biggest, baddest guy in the Marvel side of things. And everyone just said, oh, man. So even Thanos, who has this power that is just so overpowering, and he won, but yet you felt that there was hope. And they did get a couple licks in, and there was a way to do it. And it was going to take the entire Marvel universe against this guy to beat him. But there was still hope there. If Thanos just kept beating on everybody, and it's boring. It's boring.
Yeah. And you notice the only real movie with a dark ending was Infinity War.
Which is basically The Empire Strikes Back. At the end, it's like the middle part. It's the middle part. It's a two-parter.
Yeah. But if every Avengers movie or every Marvel movie had a dark ending, the audience would have been turned off a long time ago, I think.
And you know, also,
it wouldn't have been as successful.
And you also knew that Endgame was coming a few months later, however. Like, everyone knew, like, okay, we're not waiting 2 more years for this. Like, okay, it's coming next year. It's coming next summer or something like that. And we know they're coming back. Good. Yeah. But there's something like Walking Dead, they didn't. They just – it was just this constant pounding. So that's something that everyone listening, make sure whoever your protagonist is, give them a win. Even if they have a very powerful foe, which you need. You need a powerful foe to make this thing go, right?
Yeah, you need a good antagonist. You need a good nemesis. But yeah, I would say it can still – like your pilot can still end on a dark moment.
Yeah, sure.
It has to end on a trigger that triggers the first season's engine. So whatever the main conflict is going to be for that first season, it has to be generated at least by the end of the pilot, you know, and that has to be compelling. And that has to be something that you can see generating a lot of episodes. Now, it could be a loss, I guess, but it's probably a little bit better if it's a win. But really, the way I would characterize it is usually pulling the carpet out from under the protagonist, like something you didn't see coming. They didn't see coming. They never thought it would get this bad, this whatever. Maybe they're going through a gateway. Maybe a door is slammed in their face, some kind of opportunity. But the rug has been pulled out from under them. And it's like the oh shit moment, basically. at the end of every pilot, which then triggers the first season, you know? So like in Scandal, you find out during the pilot that she had a affair with the president of the United States, and he has hired her because he's been accused by an intern of having an affair, right? And she doesn't want to believe it at first. Well, by the end of the episode, she knows it was true. And so the trigger at the end is she starts representing the intern, the accuser of the president. So now she's diametrically opposed to the president, as opposed to being his former mistress and trying to help him. So that really gives you that like, oh crap moment. So now, oh, this first season, she's going to be taking on the president in addition to new cases coming in during the week.
And you know? I just finished watching How to Get Away with Murder. Which is another Shonda.
Seen that. Is that good?
It's amazing, especially that first season where, I mean, in the pilot, it's about, well, who killed this dude? And like the whole season's about who killed this person. And what's done so beautifully in that show is at the beginning of every episode, there's a flash forward to, a flashback to the night of the murder. And they just little by little, every episode, give you just a little bit more information, a little bit more information until you finally get to the answer. And it's not at the end of the season. Generally, you get to the answer by the middle of the season. And then the rest of the season, they're figuring out how to get away with it. So it's a really wonderful. It was a very unique structure of how they were able to do it. And we were hooked from the moment you watch the first episode. You're just like, okay, I heard this is good. Let's watch it. And you're just like, well, I got to know who killed him. And the way they set it all up, and then that she's a teacher, she's a lawyer who's teaching people, how you would get away with murder, how you would defend that person who got away with murder. It was just, it's wonderfully constructed.
And does she take the case at the midpoint of the season? Does she end up defending the murderer, or they're just kind of analyzing how the case might go?
She's kind of involved, but she doesn't actually, she actually never kills anybody. But she's always in the hurricane. She's always inside, and it's very close. So, I mean, I'm not giving anything away. They kill her husband. So, and you know, it's her husband. So you're wondering, did she do it? Did her students do it? Did the sister do it? Like, and you're just like this whodunit, but she's a really amazing attorney, and she, you know, and she's like a force of nature. So then she has to defend herself because she's accused, and there's all sorts of, it just constantly, you don't know. And that's the one thing I love about that show specifically. And I think if you could do this as a writer in today's world, you have a job. If you can come up with something that has not been seen before or not seen before, if you can write the story in a way that I can't tell what's going to happen next.
Surprising turns.
Yeah, you and I are both fairly educated in the story spectrum. I've seen hundreds of thousands of hours, and most people have seen that. Even if we're not in the business of constructing story, we've just seen enough to know, the bad guy's going to do this. Oh, she's going to do that. I love a show that I'm like, I'll turn to my wife and I'll just go, I have no idea what's happening. I have no idea where this is going. And that's
a good example that you said it was her husband who was killed. It has to be a consequential person. If you're going to hang a whole season on a murder case, it has to be consequential, or even just any engine. So like in Scandal, she didn't just have an affair with like some lawyer or some CEO. She had the affair with the president of the United States, you know, How to Get Away with Murder. It wasn't just some random person that was killed. It was her husband, you know? So think about that when you write your concepts, you know, that's what makes it high concept, and that, or maybe the better term is high drama, you know, high consequences.
And funny enough, that first season, that story engine, the ghost of that, even after it's resolved, it kept coming back. Mm-hmm. It kept coming back because you got away with it. That's the name of the show. You got away with murder, but it's always lingering. Is that secret, like in Mad Men? It's like that thing, and there's multiple people involved. Is anybody going to talk? And then sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And what's going to happen? And who's dead now? And oh my God. And it just constantly kept that engine going. It did finish. I think this was the last season. They did six seasons of it. But I could have kept going. But at a certain point, it started like, how many times can this person get away with murder? Like, how many times can you do this? But for the run, it was fantastic. It really, really was. Now, I don't know if we've spoken about this specifically, but the compelling crisis. Can you talk a little bit about the compelling crisis?
Yeah. So it's the core conflict. Excuse me. Sorry. It's really the core conflict. It's the core engine. I mean, we basically touched on this at the beginning. It's that engine that's going to push the story. It's that dramatic construct.
Right.
It has to be interesting. It has to be compelling. So this is basically your elevator pitch. So if you're telling someone the story, like this is a chemistry teacher turned meth cooker, you know,
right.
It has to be fascinating in its construction, you know, and that's tough to do because obviously if it wasn't tough to do, everybody would come up with a great high concept every single week, you know, but it's tough to do.
Can we just discuss what a horrible pitch Breaking Bad is? Just like on paper.
Well, it's funny that they called it, it's funny. I've seen it referred to as the greatest pitch of all time, but
yeah.
Because the initial tagline, the initial pitch was, he goes from Mr. Chips to Scarface.
Right.
So that right there, you're like, okay, well, that's at least five seasons, you know, maybe more. Here's this mild-mannered guy who's going to become this huge drug lord, you know, just absolutely ruthless guy. So that in itself was considered to be a great pitch. Now, the kind of the log line that I gave at the beginning is more the specifics, you know, his brother-in-law is a DEA agent on his tail, and he's the chemistry teacher who then is good at cooking meth, and eventually he gets kind of more and more powerful, more brutal.
Well, the way we're presenting it, the way you just presented it, sounds fantastic, but when I've seen interviews with Vince Gilligan, and he's like, on paper, you're like, oh yeah, his wife has cancer, and then he's a chemistry teacher who starts selling meth on the side to pay for the, or no, he has cancer.
He has cancer,
and like it, on paper, it just didn't,
like
nobody.
It sounds depressing.
It sounds depressing. Like what? He's got cancer. He's a chemistry teacher. He's going to sell meth. What? Like what network is going to run this? Like, and he got, and it was turned down by almost everybody except for AMC, who just said, hey, we'll take a shot on this. And even then they were like, the hatchet was just hanging over their heads for the first season, just any moment now. And it took a minute before it got up and running. Before people started, it took a little bit.
There was a whole kind of class of shows that came out of the writer's strike.
What
was that, 08?
Yeah.
And it kind of cut the season in half.
Yep.
And a lot of the networks found out that they didn't have enough content. And so they took a chance on a number of shows like Lost, Mad Men, Breaking Bad. And a lot of these great shows came out of that period. And it's probably because they took a chance on creators who weren't super established. Like J.J. Abrams and Lost, he was established more in features, not in TV. He was kind of a newcomer. Well, actually, he'd done Felicity.
And he did Alias. Yeah.
But they took a chance on Damon Lindelof, who was a newer showrunner as well there. And just the concept was crazy. He's like, oh, yeah, there's 18 main characters, and they're going to stay on this island for the whole run of the show. You know, so I think it turned out well, and it really affected kind of the history of TV because they really took a chance. You know, something like True Detective was really taking a chance as well. One director for the whole run of the season, one writer. He didn't have much experience in TV at all. I think he'd been like a staff writer on one show, Nick Pizzolatto. So, you know, when you take chances, it can pay off. Of course, the landscape's also littered with canceled shows where it didn't pay off, you know.
Right.
But write something that you want to see, write something that does take some chances, and that's how you're going to stand out. You know, it's your unique voice that's going to make you stand out.
So is there... a difference in structure regarding and just story mapping ideas in general with sitcoms and maybe a 30-minute dramedy as opposed to the one-hour drama?
There is, yeah. If you really want to get technical, and the story map breaks this down in the beat sheet, so a one-hour pilot, the structure is going to be either teaser plus four or teaser plus five. Mm-hmm. So basically, that's if you're considering the teaser as an act, that's five or six acts total. And then with a 30-minute, either sitcom or dramedy, it's usually going to be cold open slash teaser. Sometimes they call it cold open, plus three acts or plus four acts. Your average sitcom, let's say one that I've mapped would be The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix. Mm-hmm. That was teaser plus three. And then a dramedy like Atlanta on FX, that was teaser plus four. Maybe you would say, okay, dramedies have a little bit more complex storytelling. That could be the case. As far as the actual pilot script themselves, this is the pilot that you're going to submit to an agent, manager, network executive, producer, whatever. Your one-hour pilot script is going to be like 54 to 60 pages. I recommend you don't go over 60 pages if you're a newbie. And then a half-hour script, whether sitcom or dramedy, is going to be more in like the 32 to 38 page range. And people ask, okay, well, if I'm writing a network sitcom with commercials, the sitcom actually only ends up being 23 minutes, you know, so should I write a 23 page script? The answer is no. You should still write a 32 to 38 page script, maybe 30, because they're going to end up cutting some material because the actors are going to deliver it faster. I mean, comedy is all about pacing. So that just is the industry standard that you're going to write in that range. Now, if you're a newcomer, I wouldn't say 38 pages. I'd say keep it 32 to 35, something like that, you know.
And do you and all the same ideas as far as a compelling character, the story engine. I mean, because sitcoms are different. Like the sitcom, the mm-hmm. log line just has to kind of like, you know, All in the Family. I mean, it's basically that log line, Golden Girls, you know, I'm going old school, sorry. or Big Bang Theory, you know, mm-hmm. bunch of nerds trying to figure out life with, you know, a hot girl across the hall, essentially, and how that works mm-hmm. out. I don't know if that's even the log line. I don't even know what the log line of a show like that is. Mm-hmm. But
are the elements the same? They're basically the same. I mean, you do have a protagonist who probably has a quirk or a misbehavior, mm-hmm. And they may have Achilles heel, but the stakes aren't as high. You know, obviously it's not going to be life or death if it's a sitcom. Mm-hmm. But one thing that, and then there is a compelling crisis, there's an urgent crisis for that particular pilot episode. Okay. So they may be the same, they may not. So like the compelling crisis of, let's say, Big Bang Theory may be these guys trying to negotiate the real world, even though they're the biggest nerds on the planet, and kind of get along with girls, okay, you know, as frontline by their neighbor. But the urgent crisis of the pilot is that particular story that week, that particular challenge that they have to deal with. And I don't remember the pilot of
it. I don't either.
But one thing, if you talk about the 30-minute dramedy, which is the hottest format today, in which you see a lot more shows using that format, mm-hmm. a lot more shows on Netflix using the 30-minute dramedy format, a lot more on Amazon, shows like Dead to Me on Netflix, Love on Netflix, and Atlanta, like I mentioned, Master of None on different networks. So they really focus on a subculture, and the subculture of the dramedy is really important in those cases. So you really want to drill down into a world that we haven't seen before. Okay, Transparent, for example, it was examining the impact of a parent who is transitioning to another gender and the impact on his adult children. Okay, and that was something we hadn't seen before, you know. It really kind of changed the zeitgeist, and it's a really unique, interesting show. And Transparent, there really was more drama than comedy, although there were some really funny moments. But it was really more like kind of 70% drama, 30% comedy, if you had to, you know.
So like a show like Master of None, what is the subculture there Because I haven't seen the show in a bit, but I'm trying to remember.
Good question. I would say it's the Indian American man who and his family, because we do touch on his parents, and there are flashbacks to his parents in India and coming to America. So it's the Indian American man trying to struggle as an actor. Okay. And then we get into, there's other characters. There's the Lena Waithe character, who's a gay black woman, and her family also is examined. There was a great episode, which I may have won the Emmy, called Three Thanksgivings, and three or four Thanksgivings. And it goes back in time, kind of showing her coming out of the closet with each Thanksgiving when she was younger with her family. So we examined her family, you know? So it was family dynamics. It was a struggling actor. It was a young guy trying to find a partner, you know, trying to find a woman and settle down. His friends are settling down, and he's still the single guy in the city, kind of trying to grow up, basically. You know, Rami on Hulu is also about a guy trying to grow up in the modern world and become an adult as he lives at home with his family. But the subculture there is Muslim America. So he's a Muslim. And really, I haven't seen any other show that really had a main character who was a Muslim that was kind of really broke out, you know. And Rami's a great show to look at. That's a great dramedy.
Now, as a writer, do you, if you're creating a pilot for any of these shows, a 30-minute dramedy, a one-hour drama, do you need a story Bible?
Well, it depends. If you're, do you mean like a pitch Bible that you show to people?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like if you need to understand where the series can go, at least for the season, and then possibly for two or three, and then ideas for two or three seasons ahead of that.
Yeah, yeah, you do. You need to understand that. And I would say it would be good to have that written document. Today you see a lot of pitch decks where there's a lot of visuals, you know, a lot of images, and they talk a lot about tone, and they show like pictures of actors who capture that, the essence of that character. So they're a lot more visual, but you can do one that's purely text-based. And yeah, you want to define the characters in more detail so that you know going forward what their arcs are going to be and who they are, really, so you can write them better. And the arcs going forward in season one, and then ideally season two, season three, maybe beyond that. But you don't need to have like the entire first three seasons mapped out, but it is good to have a good idea of the major arcs.
Now, can we discuss a little bit about theme within shows? Because theme is obviously a very powerful thing that a lot of times gets lost in the writing process. In television shows, can you talk about certain shows and see what the theme, underlining theme is of each show and how important it might be to the success of a show?
Yeah, yeah. Well, basically, theme is what is your show about? Like, why are you telling this story? What about it fascinates you and should fascinate the audience? What emotions and ideas do you plan to explore? And that can lend itself to inspiring what the characters will do, their actions and the plot lines and the beats. A theme, to mention Mad Men again, the theme would be the pursuit of happiness in an increasingly cynical and chaotic world. Now, that is pretty broad, but each character is dealing with trying to be happy in this chaotic time of the 1960s in New York City. And it's really, the world is throwing things at them, and they're just trying to get along with their spouse or find a spouse or raise a family or balance the job and home life. There's a lot of dealing with sexism. There's a lot of dealing with racism. And in that case, it was really key that it was that subculture of Manhattan in the 1960s. But other shows, I would say Breaking Bad, the theme of sacrifice comes into play time and time again. Walter White is put in these impossible situations. And the idea is, what is he willing to sacrifice to save his own skin? In some cases, it's literally his own skin. Like, he'll be tied up and he, you know, jury rigs something to burn the ties on his wrists or something. And he burns himself to do it. You know, like, is he willing to go through that much pain, or is he willing, the big overriding theme is he willing to sacrifice his family? And that's the big thing. That's really his goal from the beginning, is to make enough money to support his family if he dies from cancer. So after he dies, and the cancer element is taken out of it at a certain point. And it's when it's more about him being Scarface, you know, it's more about his quest for power. But at a certain point late in the game, his wife does find out that he is this meth cooker, and she gets in on the business, and they run the car wash, which is their front. You know, that's how they launder the money.
It's literally a car wash, which was so beautiful. Yeah. It was like they're literally washed.
Probably intentional.
Yeah. Oh, obviously. Yeah, there's no question. They're like, oh, we're going to wash money at the car wash.
Yeah, yeah. And the pilot, the end of the pilot is he's washing and literally drying his money. He has cash in the dryer. So it's literally like he's washing the money. So
now, what are some of the biggest mistakes you see writers make when putting together a pilot?
Using too much of a closed ending so that there isn't that season one trigger to trigger mm-hmm. the rest of the show. The scenes are too long and the act breaks are not where they should be. You know, my beat sheet defines your act break, defines the signpost beats of your, plot. Mm-hmm. And it also defines, where they fall in the script. Okay. So I have a very specific, page range paradigm that I've constructed, but it's based on produced shows, hit shows, and professional pilots that I read. So like, for example, I have the teaser of a 1-hour drama should be 2 to 10 pages. Act one should be 12 to 15 pages. Act two should be 6 to 10 pages, and it should end around page 30. And I continue through to act five. So if you read my book, Story Maps, TV Drama, then you'll see these breakdowns and you'll know basically how long you have for each act. And it really is empowering, and it gives you kind of a deadline and a target, you know. And it is easier to write if you know, okay, I'm writing act two and I only have 10 pages and it should end around page 30. You know, it's actually liberating, because then you don't write 35 pages, and it gives you some discipline to know that this is the industry standard structure. You know, I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it does. It does. It does. Now, are there any bad habits that screenwriters writing a show have that they should kind of rid themselves of? Like, you've seen this again and again and again. You're like, oh God, please stop mm-hmm. this.
Well, it's funny. I had heard years ago that there was a huge flood of pilots that were just like Breaking Bad, Bad's pilot, you know, because it was so popular at the time. But, yeah, like I said, there isn't a trigger to trigger season one. There isn't that compelling crisis, really. It's a one-off story, you know, so there's not that, fascinating conflict that can keep repeating. Just the characters are not that interesting. There is a lack of conflict. They really have to generate conflict, and each scene has to have conflict and ideally increasing stakes. There isn't a midpoint. Like, there should still be a midpoint in a pilot, just as there is a midpoint in a feature, and that should be really strong. And then there should be an all is lost moment, that really hitting bottom moment that happens at the end of act four, if you're talking about teaser plus five acts.
Now,
there's an all is lost in the 30 minute structure as well.
Now, how do you approach rewriting, the rewriting process, which is, just brutal?
Are you not do well with rewrites?
I mean, I don't mind rewrites, actually. I actually enjoy going back and rewriting, because it's just honing what you've done before. But for when I'm doing story specifically, nonfiction is a lot easier. But for fiction, you start killing those darlings. And it's hard. Yeah. It's hard to kill the darlings. And that's one thing I know a lot of writers, like, I've read so many screenplays that are, you know, it shouldn't be 135 pages. You know, it really needs to be 92. You know, it's just because
it need to be 135?
Yeah. It really doesn't. You know, I mean, is this Braveheart? No, I don't know. Yeah. So, at a certain point, it's hard to cut those out. So any suggestions or any advice?
Well, yeah, I would say you have the story map paradigm, you know, that comes from my book and the worksheet. If your listeners, if you want to email me at dan@act4screenplays.com, I will send you a worksheet for the 1 hour drama and the 30 minute if you want. Mm-hmm. So you have that worksheet and that paradigm so you can do better at hitting those page points in your subsequent drafts. And then, as you know, you want to give it to friends and get feedback from other people. And that's tough because you do end up killing those darlings. You know, that favorite scene that you love, someone, you give it to three friends and two of them are like, you don't need that scene. You know, you should cut that scene. And that's when that kind of separates the men from the boys. You know, that's the tough thing that you have to do, that professional writers have to do, is be able to cut those scenes that just aren't working, aren't pushing the story forward. They don't have enough conflict. Right. They're just not crucial, you know?
Right. And a lot of times it's just like, there's a cool line in that scene or there's a cool thing that happens in that scene, but it's not really moving the story forward. It's fluff, but it's really cool fluff. Exactly. And that's tough to cut those.
Yeah. And every scene should A, move the story forward, B, reveal crucial character, or C, really explore the theme, you know, in a unique way that isn't explored in other scenes. Ideally, all three of those, but it should hit at least one of those. And it should, you know, the most important is moving the story forward.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests, sir. Okay. What are three television pilots every screenwriter should read?
Okay. I would say, and I'll try to deviate from just the ones in my book, because I have seven in my book that I break down. I would say Breaking Bad, Ozark. Mm-hmm. I really love Ozark these days. And wow, I would say to throw in a half an hour one, I would say Dead to Me, also on Netflix.
Okay.
So two Netflix and an AMC.
All right. Now, what advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
Write a lot, have more than one sample that is ready and polished. I mean, if you have the greatest script in the world and you only have one, yes, that can launch your career. But you want to show a manager or an agent that you're not just a one-trick pony and that you do have more than one script. So I would say have a portfolio of 2 to 3 really strong pilots and ideally secure a manager first. Before, and then they can get you staffing jobs. But 99% of staffing jobs are in LA. So if you're going to be a TV writer, you do want to eventually, I would say, come to LA.
And where can people find you and the work you're doing?
You can find me at act4screenplays.com. That's ACTFOUR screenplays.com. I have bunch of interviews around on the internet and like Film Courage and Indie Film Hustle and LA Screenwriter. I have books on Amazon. My most popular book is the one that is on the 1 hour film structure, which is called Story Maps TV Drama, the structure of the 1 hour TV pilot. And I have webinars also that you can get on my site at act4screenplays.com. There's a webinars tab. I have one called The Screenwriting Secrets of Netflix, and then I have some that detail the 1 hour beat sheet, the 30 minute beat sheet, and the 30 minute dramedy. So there's a whole wealth of ways you can learn from my methods.
Daniel, thank you so much for being on the show again, sir, and dropping those knowledge bombs on the tribe today. So I appreciate it, brother.
You're welcome. Well, thanks for having me. I always enjoy it.
I want to thank Daniel for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs on the Bulletproof Screenwriting Tribe today. Thank you so much, Daniel. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including copies of his book and other services that he provides, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/086. And guys, if you haven't already, check out our new course at IFH Academy called The Foundations of Screenwriting Story Development, taught by Jeffrey Calhoun from the Script Summit. And in the course, he talks about concept development, understanding theme, character development, character sheets, internal versus external conflict, sympathy versus empathy, and so much more. If you want to get access to it, just head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/ story course. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.